Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
Shorts!
From
WNYC.
Yes.
And NPR.
You have a good sense of what you want to tell me?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, I'm Jad.
I am Robert.
This is Radiolab, the podcast.
The podcast.
Can I just start us off with a moment of appreciation? I'm very excited for what you're going to play for us today. Because sometimes, you know, you talk to people on stage, smart people, and you did one recently for the World Science Festival.
Yes.
And we put it on every so often on the podcast, but we don't do it enough.
Well, we're going to do it now.
Let's do it.
So in just a moment, I'm going to introduce you to two gentlemen who are nothing short of remarkable. But before I do, I just...
So we go now to the Danny and Sylvia K. Auditorium at the campus of Hunter College in Manhattan.
Wait a second. Just set it up for us a little bit. Like, what are we about to do?
So the idea of this World Science Festival evening, there are people who wander around the world who have a problem which is called face blindness.
Weirdly, both these men are face blind. So when they look at a face for 10, 20, 60 minutes, the other guy's face just doesn't get in or stick into their heads.
Huh.
I chose two people.
One of them
is Oliver Sacks, our regular.
Oliver?
He's a neuroscientist, and he's like...
Oliver is face blind?
Oh boy, is he face blind. I mean,
he can't recognize faces?
Well, you'll see.
The other guy, who we're going to call Chuck...
The other guy is one of the greatest portrait artists in the world.
He has, as many of you know, for decades now, created art, big paintings, some little, but usually huge paintings, mostly of faces. Wow. Here he is, Chuck Close.
I thought it would be interesting to bring these two people together, face blind Oliver, face blind Chuck, and discuss what many people think of as a very rare situation.
Who are you guys again?
We don't know who you are either. All right, so the both of you, how long ago did you discover, if indeed that's the right word, that you were unusual in this regard? Oliver.
I think probably when I was high to everyone.
Oh, you can't hear? Okay, so tell you what, I'll just stick this thing in front of you.
Okay.
And say something.
Say something.
That's better. All right. Mm-hmm. So you missed the first part of the program, but Oliver was saying.
Okay.
So you were in a class with other kids. If you had a friend who was like, you know, a pal, would you take a beat to know who it was?
Yeah. So say Jonathan Miller became a good friend. He's tall and gangly. He has red hair, and his movements are fluid and evocative and wonderful. And
if Jonathan Miller was brought in paralyzed and totally straight, would you know it was Jonathan Miller? Or do you have to see the hair and the movements?
No. When I have got to know someone well, then I will recognize the face. But it takes a long while. And with...
And even then, it has to be reinforced, right? You have to keep seeing them.
So if you've spent 4 minutes with the person, and then you walk away and come back 2 minutes later, do you know who the person is? If 20 minutes with the person, time make a difference?
I tend to lose it within minutes.
Within minutes. You? Same problem?
Same problem. I can spend an evening talking to someone, looking at them across the table, and I'd see them the next day. I'd have no idea I'd ever seen them, nor do I remember their name.
But when they open their mouth, would you say, oh, that's the one, or not even?
No. And a lot of it's context. If they walk into my studio, I figure they've walked into my studio because they're supposed to be there. Then I then I interview them for a while to find out who they are.
Are you just trying to subtly find, like, so who is this? Is that
who the hell is this person? Why are they in my studio?
Now, in your case, if that person were to suddenly flatten out and work its, and be still on a page.
Well, everything in my work is determined by my learning disabilities. So, faceblind, I'm sure I was driven to paint portraits by being faceblind. That is, I know now that if I can flatten an image out and scan it the way I work, I can commit it to memory. And I have almost photographic memory for things that are flat.
And still.
Still, yeah. But
being in space and moving around makes the face invisible. Fixing it makes the face memorable.
You move your head a half an inch to me, it's a whole new face I've never seen before.
Wow. Oh. Have you ever not recognized yourself?
I'm always, several times I have started apologizing to large, clumsy, bearded people and realize that it's a mirror.
It's a mirror?
It's a mirror. Oh. But it's even gone a stage further than that. Fairly recently I was in a cafe in Chelsea Market with tables outside, and while I was waiting for my food, I do what people with beards often do. I started to preen myself, and then I realized that my reflection was not doing the same thing. And that inside there was a man with a beard, possibly you, who wondered why I was sort of, making faces at him. So I may take other people to be myself, as well as failing to recognize myself.
I was wondering how you once you realized that you were preening your beard in front of a bearded man, did you look down and?
I did look abashed. I often look abashed.
Well, now let me just ask about: is this just a face problem? What about emotional? If you can't see a face, can you ever read sadness, happiness?
Yeah, I don't think I have any trouble reading how someone is feeling. I think I'm actually pretty good at that. You know, the way I work is to make this kind of Brobdingnagian world in which I make the face into a landscape. And I journey across that landscape like Gulliver's Lilliputians, crawling over the face of a giant, not knowing that they were on the face of a giant, but knowing everything about that face. And then what I do is I put all that information together, the kind of nose and nostril, the corners of the mouth, whatever, and I can commit it to memory. So I know that it's no accident that I was driven to make portraits of people who matter to me.
But if the person whose face you can't read's lips are trembling, or if they have a downcast look in the eye, or if they're being brave, can you assign emotion to a facet of a face?
Yeah.
And you too?
Well,
to the mic.
Okay. Well, I can't paint or whatever, but I think I'm as sensitive to emotion as, and little things, including little grimaces which indicate that someone is lying.
Now here's a difference I sense, just to complete this sort of look of what you can and can't do. Oliver can remember, when I ask you about things you've written 22 years ago, a lot of times if you talk to an author about something they wrote 22 years ago, they give you a sad look of, well, that was a long time ago. But you seem to remember much of what you have learned. You seem to remember very little of what you have learned. Well, let me be gentler about that. Like, when you were in high school, it was time to take the test.
Right.
You once described to me an all-night bathtub.
No, I used a kind of sensory deprivation tank in order to memorize things. And It's very hard for me. I don't know how to add or subtract without using the spots on dominoes, a visual system. I still don't know the multiplication tables. I didn't take algebra, geometry, physics, or chemistry. If the junior college in my hometown had not taken every taxpayer's son or daughter, I could never have gone to college.
Wow. So you're a wreck, really.
Yes.
But the coping part of this for both of you has been kind of interesting, because both of you are very, very smart, so you just put your intelligence where you have to.
One of the great quotes I've ever heard is from the great painter Robert Rauschenberg, who was about the most learning disabled dyslexic person I've ever known. And he said, when you're this way, you have to find other venues for your intelligence.
Right.
You have to prove to your teachers that even though you're not going to be able to spit back the names or dates, that you care about the material. And we have to prove to the people who we see that we care about them, even though we're not going to recognize their faces and maybe remember their names. So you have to be charming, you have to be a bullshitter, you have to be fast on your feet and figure out how you're going to explain your way out of the fact that you don't know who they are or remember them.
Do you find people calling you like a snob or, I mean, like what do you mean you don't know me? I'm the host of this dinner party kind of thing.
Yes, usually my assistant, Kate, will say to people beforehand, before they come in, don't ask if he remembers you, because he'll say no. And to me, she says, don't just say no. Say, I'm awful with faces. I wouldn't recognize my own mother.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not good at bullshitting. Mm-hmm. I tend to withdraw.
You withdraw?
Yeah.
So you solve it by going into a corner and not talking to anybody?
Well, it doesn't solve it. It often makes it worse. But
my approach is to be more outgoing, more friendly, whatever, and to try and charm my way through things. And I also lecture and talk all the time about face blindness and my other problems so that people are aware that I have them and they'll cut me some slack.
But you go out like every chance you can, mm-hmm. right? And you stay in every chance you can, right?
Well, more or less.
Yeah.
No, I don't stay in, but there are other things beside human beings. When, for example, I first visited Australia, I came back with hundreds of photos, and people looked through them and said, yes, but didn't you meet any human beings? Because all my photos were of scenery and plants, where I'm very at home.
And I noticed that when you get in the elevator in your apartment, you don't have any idea who the neighbors are, but you do look down, right?
Oh, I know they're dogs.
Yeah. So if they were to switch dogs, you'd just be...
Well, I wouldn't notice.
Yeah. No.
But if you see them without the dog, you don't know who they are, right?
No idea.
Yeah.
So this charm offensive that you go on, what does that, like how, if you have no idea who you're talking to, what are the charm moves?
Well, not always is it charming. I didn't recognize a woman I'd lived with for a year, two years later, and there's no amount of charm that is going to get you through a mistake like that.
Like, do you make fun of yourself?
Or? Oh, yeah. Oh. Self-deprecating humor will cover a great deal. And if you laugh at yourself, you're giving permission for other people to see it as less than the most tragic condition. It is funny, you know? It's funny. I wish I didn't have it, but it's funny.
What about...
Lots of neurological conditions are comic. They can be both awful and comic.
Yeah.
And it's important.
Well, there's a gallows humor in rehabilitation hospitals, sure. Yeah. for that very reason, you know.
What about let's narrow down the techniques here. Can you sometimes not see the face but see the hair, the ears, yeah. the something?
Oh, absolutely. If someone has large outsticking ears or hooked nose or a little triangular beard, or if the glasses are of a particular sort, I'm better at recognizing caricatures than portraits. Because in a caricature, salient features are exaggerated. Mm. And for me, it's to some extent, I have to make an inventory of salient features.
You talk about Gulliver and that process. Do you think of what you do as an expression of the situation you find yourself in?
Sure. In every way. I mean, I have trouble in a global sense with the whole. But if you break it down into small enough bite-sized units, incremental units, then I make this big overwhelming problem into thousands of little more solvable problems. I've just found a way to, take my deficits and use them rather than banging my head against the wall.
Well, let me show you Lyle. This is Chuck 15, and then we'll do Chuck 16. So in Chuck 15, it's going to be a person you know named, who is Lyle?
By Wait, now what's happening? What is this right here?
So, Jared, what you should do is you should imagine it's a detailed slide, and what you see is lots of boxes with almost like mirror-like shiny nuggets in each box.
Is this when you're looking at a Chuck Close painting really close? Is that what you're describing?
Yes, it's a detail. So it's the lower lip and chin of somebody who he calls Lyle.
When people stand right in front of Lyle's mouth, there's a little bit of confusion. You can't quite read it right away.
Well, the closer you get to something, normally the more information you get. But the closer you get to one of mine, the less information you have. You have information.
But when you step back, these very abstract, flat little cells suddenly turn into a very interesting face.
Well, here's what I don't understand, though. If he's blind to the face, how do you even build it up? Like, don't you have to be able to see the thing that you're building to?
If he can fix it, which the photograph does.
Oh, he takes a picture first.
He takes a picture first.
And then what?
Then he graphs it, so he makes it into lots of little boxes. It looks like a giant checkerboard. And then he goes into each checkerboard, and he then repaints it.
Oh.
Magically, when you step away, there is the thing that you can't see.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah. So he's able to see the details within those boxes well enough to be able to construct them and then trust that what will emerge is a face.
Yep. And the magical part is not only do you suddenly get the reveal of the face, but with the reveal comes a sense of the person. Okay, so let's go back to the situation.
So now, Oliver, you have been losing your depth perception. So he takes the world in 3D and puts it into 2D in all these fleshy and interesting ways. You have always been, all your life, a 3D man.
Passionately.
Passionately. Yes. What's happening to you now?
Well, now I've lost the sight of one eye. Everything for me is on a plane. And on a flat surface.
Does that mean that when you look at art, that things that used to bore you now, you know, the flat things get better and spatial things get worse?
Well, there has been a paradox in that for me, previously, until a few months ago, the world consisted of solid objects residing in space and with space between them. Now the objects are, as it were, painted on a flat plane, and I think that the sense of visual composition, which is not a word I ever use, a concept I ever had strongly, I think that is stronger. Unfortunately, I can't paint, but I do in fact find myself enjoying paintings more, especially sort of rather flat medieval ones. I partly feel I'm in a sort of 13th century world.
And I'm sitting here with one eye closed, which is what I've done my whole life. Because I have double vision if I have both eyes open. And, so I close one eye and I flatten the world out. And I have a much better chance of getting around in it. So you see the wrinkles on this eye.
Yeah, you have.
Because it's been closed virtually my entire life.
By the way, is there any cure for this that we know that if you have this facial blindness, does anyone get cured of it?
Not so far as I know.
Okay.
I think it's important to say, and You know, I portrayed myself as sort of as withdrawn or helpless, but I think I also have a vivid love of humanity, as Chuck has. But for me, the portraits take the form of narratives, of stories.
Yeah. Well, your words paint the most specific portraits of people's lives, and I always have identified your characters as vivid a portrait as anything anybody could do in any other art form. And I mean, you celebrate your connectedness with humanity in a really important way. I mean, it's a way that we can identify with, even if it's a problem we don't have. Empathy is the basis of, I think, the mortar that holds society together. And telling stories in a riveting way that allows us to empathize and care about these people. My grandfather had Tourette syndrome, and reading about a character with Tourette syndrome in one of your books, I cried through the whole thing.
Can I ask about the cause of this condition? You can get face blindness from a stroke, right? Can you get it from a tumor?
Yes, or head injury, or whatever affects a particular part of the brain, a small area in the visual cortex. People call it the fusiform gyrus, the fusiform face area. Actually, there are a number of different face areas, and normally these connect up with memories of faces and things. But something which was not recognized until very recently and is still very insufficiently recognized is what Chuck and I have, which is lifelong face blindness, and which is often strongly familial. And there, if you do...
Strongly familial, yeah. Meaning genetic, perhaps?
Yes.
How widespread is this condition? The two of you have it.
The best estimate is that fairly severe. I mean, there may well be a symmetrical curve. Chuck and I are in the worst 2 or 3%, mm-hmm. but probably not the worst 1%. There right. are people who are far, far worse.
So you're going to give me a guess? You think it's like 10% yes, of the world, no, or 1%?
The fairly severely affected people are 2 to 3%, which is what 6 to 8 million people in this country.
Let's do a test to see whether this audience. Let's just see how good or bad you guys are. We're going to do a little fun test of your face, and the way it works is that 10 celebrity faces...
What is this?
So here's what's happening. We decided to give the whole audience a face test.
10 celebrity faces will be flashed on the screen for 15 seconds each.
Now, we took 10 very famous celebrities. They included the President of the United States of America, fabulous movie stars from the past and the present.
You just put their face up and say, do you recognize
them? We put their faces up, but we erased their hair.
Huh. Oh, just the face?
Only the face.
That's interesting.
So imagine like Johnny Depp, but no hair.
Take away his hair. The question is, would they recognize?
Would you recognize this person?
I would think people would recognize. I mean,
well, so would I. But when I read out the names, here I am reading out the names.
Number 6 is Johnny Depp.
No.
Johnny Depp.
That's what he's like without hair?
That's what he's like without hair.
People sound surprised.
I'm going to ask for a show of hands, all right, now.
And so then I said, well,
please raise your hand if you got any person right. Anyone at all.
You know, almost everybody. Okay. Oh, me.
Lower your hand if you only got 1 or 2 right.
Okay, so now some hands go down.
Lower your hand if you only got 3 right.
So now, yeah, we're beginning.
Phrasing this in an odd way, only got 3 right.
Lower your hand if you only got 4 right.
Only is such a funny word.
Yeah, it's just a...
Yeah, thank you, Chuck.
We keep going.
Please now, lower your hand if you only got 9 right. The remaining hands...
Wait, how many hands are up at this point?
About 6.
Out of like 1,000?
Yep.
How many... The remaining hands are, I got 10. Could you stand if you got 10? I'd just like to see who you are.
All right.
Wow. Could the number of people, what?
They're all women.
Wow.
Oh, they're all women, that's interesting. All right, sit down, super people. How many people got none right? Could you please rise? Absolutely none. I mean, let's see if there are more
of
you.
All men?
I wanted to know if anyone was just totally blind.
And?
About 10 people were totally blind, got none right at all.
My wife got none right? Oh, my God.
Yeah, right, my wife got none. She was amazed. So this is the thing. So the question then becomes, so, a lot of people really do have this problem.
So there are a lot of people who may be leading lives of embarrassment and partial disability and secrecy and shame.
I evolved all sorts of coping mechanisms with dyslexia, many of which are now taught, you know, to people who have other problems. But there are unfortunately no real answers to coping with...
Well, you have some. Charm it out,
hide. Yeah, well, I mean, you're not... You're
paint.
Not going to lessen the deficit by having a good attitude or trying harder or whatever. It is what it is.
I want to thank the World Science Festival, to Brian Greene and Tracy Day, who run the thing. It comes every spring in New York City. Lots of scientists. And
boy, does it come. It comes like a comet.
Yes. And we over at Radiolab are the... Jad was there this year. He did
animals.
Animals.
Yes.
And
like we haven't done that enough.
Well, like we don't know faces. But it's the World Science Festival, so we say
the
hello
world
to the world.
Science
we say thank you to science.
Thank you to festivals.
We know how to party with the best of them.
And thank you to you for listening.
Thank you.
I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
See ya.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and...
Hi, this is Alicia Sunsmo, Radio Lab listener from Grinnell, Iowa. The Radio Lab podcast is funded in part by the National Science Foundation and the Sloan Foundation. Thank you.
End of message.
Radio Lab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.